The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And today we're reading from The Week magazine, dated March 9th, 2012. As usual, we'll begin with the main story section from The Week magazine. The first article here is entitled, Romney's Back in Front. What happened? Mitt Romney regained front-runner status in the Republican presidential race last week, overcoming Rick Santorum's populist challenge to win crucial primary contests in his home state of Michigan and in Arizona. Having fallen behind Santorum in the polls in recent weeks, Romney eked out a 3-point victory in the state where he grew up when his father served as governor. He won Arizona by a far more definitive 19-point margin. The impact of his first-place finish in Michigan on the larger race was chiefly symbolic, as the state's delegates are to be provided proportionately with Santorum. But the twin victories provided a momentum change for the former Massachusetts governor ahead of next week's Super Tuesday contest, when 10 states go to the polls to select 437 delegates. We didn't win by a lot, but we won by enough, and that's what counts, Romney said. And, of course, as you know, you've heard about the results of the Super Tuesday primaries this past Tuesday, which came after press time for The Week magazine. Romney continued to do well, winning 6 of the states there, while Santorum won 3. And we'll have more details about that in The Week magazine for next week. After surging in recent weeks, though, Santorum hurt himself before this week's primaries with several highly controversial comments. He called President Obama a snob for encouraging all Americans to attend college, and said that John F. Kennedy's famous 1960 speech emphasizing the separation of church and state made him want to throw up. Now here's what the editorial said. Mitt Romney is finally beginning to look like a winner, said the Wall Street Journal. Having looked lost for much of February, he staged a comeback in Michigan this past week by hammering home his economic credentials, unveiling a welcome agenda of 20% across-the-board tax cuts that appeal to Midwestern voters far more than Santorum's focus on social issues. The gaffe-prone Romney is not a very good campaigner, but his resilience speaks well of his determination. Santorum, meanwhile, is disqualifying himself as a serious presidential contender, said the Washington Post. His attacks on JFK and his apocalyptic talk of a war on people of faith may appeal to paranoid religious conservatives, but it sounds ridiculous to everyone else. We admire Santorum's deeply held beliefs, said NationalReview.com, but he needs to reel himself in. You can't run for president by speaking of Satan and calling liberal Protestant denominations distortions of the creed. America does not want a theologist in chief. Now here's what the columnist said. Mitt Romney didn't win Michigan, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Santorum lost it with unforced errors. After his criticism of contraception, he lost women by 6 points in Michigan. Even Catholics, whom you'd expect to support him in droves, went for Romney by a 6-point margin in both Arizona and Michigan. If these defeats teach Santorum anything, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post, it should be that his disdain for snobs who want their children to get college educations is not shared by ordinary Americans. For all the Republican talk of Democratic class warfare against the 1%, it's Santorum who has the deeply chiseled chip on his shoulder. Romney has the opposite problem. He has no appeal to working class voters, said Jonathan Cohn in the NewRepublic.com. He actually lost in Michigan among voters making less than $100,000 a year, which is no surprise given the fact that he keeps revealing himself as an out-of-touch plutocrat. Over the past week alone, he cheerfully boasted that his wife owned two Cadillacs and allowed that while he didn't follow NASCAR, he had some great friends that are team owners. He has no chance of beating President Obama if he can't win over at least some middle-class voters. Now the landscape changes again, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. Super Tuesday could enable Newt Gingrich, who is polling well in southern states like Georgia and Tennessee, to get back in the race, further diluting the delegate poll. Or the delegate pool, that is. The biggest prize is Ohio, where Romney and Santorum will battle it out. If Romney has a weak showing that night, the GOP elites may start panicking and talking up a brokered convention, said Ed Kilgore in the NewRepublic.com. But if he keeps Santorum at bay, the power brokers will add up the delegate totals, the bank balances, and the increasing odds against a dark horse candidate and figure that Mitt is inevitable again. And again, we'll have more details about Super Tuesday coming up next week in our Reading of the Week magazine. Our next item is entitled Escalating Bloodshed in Syria. What happened? Ignoring international demands for a ceasefire, the Syrian military this week stepped up its assault on the rebel stronghold of Homs by sending in ground troops and tanks. The escalation came after 4 weeks of relentless bombardment of the city's opposition-held neighborhoods in which hundreds have been killed. In Geneva, the UN Human Rights Council condemned Damascus for unspeakable violations, causing the Syrian envoy to storm out. Earlier, the more than 60 nations of the Friends of the Syria group meeting in Tunisia called for President Bashar al-Assad to resign, and U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that Russia and China's continuous support for him was despicable. In defiance of international pressure, Assad's regime staged a referendum on a new constitution and claimed it was overwhelmingly approved. The document purports to allow multiple parties in a country that has been ruled by the Ba'ath Party since 1963. The opposition boycotted the vote, which was widely seen as a sham. Now here's what the editorial said. It's time to arm the rebels, said the New Republic. Months of diplomacy have utterly failed Syria. Thousands of people have died, and thousands more will die if the West does not turn to military options to stop Assad's brutal onslaught. No one, of course, wants American troops involved in yet another war, but we simply must help the rebels stop Assad's mass murder by arming them or using some degree of air power on their behalf, or both. Who exactly would be armed? Asked the Christian Science Monitor. The Syrian opposition is badly splintered. At the Friends of Syria conference, the various groups, some armed, some pacifist, still put issues of ethnicity and religion, not to mention contending claims for legitimacy and leadership, over the higher ideals of the Arab Spring. This fragmentation makes all options murky. Now here's what the columnist said. There's an alternative to arming the rebels, said Anne-Marie Slaughter in NewYorkTimes.com. To protect all Syrians, no-kill zones could be set up near the Turkish, Lebanese, and Jordanian borders, which could be easily accessed by the Red Cross. The Free Syrian Army, armed by its neighbors, would control these zones. Special forces from Qatar and Turkey, and even Britain and France, would assist the rebels with intelligence. The condition for such aid would be that it be used defensively, only to stop attacks by the Syrian military or to clear out government forces that dare to attack the no-kill zones. This would make it easier for Syrian troops to defect and create zones of peace in what are now zones of death. Such a plan ignores basic military realities, said Stephen Walt in foreignpolicy.com. Maybe you can distinguish between defensive and offensive fighting on paper, but not in practice. What sounds at first like a noble effort to protect civilians would quickly turn into offensive action against a despised regime. The resulting protracted conflict would make the present carnage look mild by comparison. Indeed, any outside intervention in Syria would likely make things worse, said Paul Valley in the London Independent. Syria has nerve gas, chemical weapons, and a standing army of 250,000 troops. And it has even bigger friends in the playground. Russia and China will block any action in the UN, and Iran has already sent warships to Syria. Worse, Western spooks fear that the incohate anti-Assad coalition could hide a potent cohort of jihadists, an anxiety fed by the recent endorsement of the Syrian rebels by al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. There's another solution, the Yemen model, said Jane Harman in the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. could offer Assad the same immunity arrangement that former Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh received in exchange for a quiet departure from power. Assad's exit would end the carnage in homes without all the risks of arming rebels we don't really know. Once he's gone, a unity government could take shape. If Assad were allowed to leave with a guarantee of safe haven, the real work of encouraging a Syrian-led transition to a democratic and pluralistic political system could finally begin. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week, entitled, Afghanistan, Is the War Unraveling? Afghanistan has become a fiercely inhospitable place for U.S. troops, said Newsday in an editorial, and the past week has made it clearer than ever that we've overstayed our welcome. Furious anti-American protests have spread across Afghanistan after several members of the U.S. military burned multiple copies of the Quran in a pile of trash at Bagram Air Base. President Obama quickly expressed his deep regret over the incident, but the violence continued to escalate. A member of the Afghan army gunned down two U.S. soldiers at a base in eastern Afghanistan. And at the highly guarded Interior Ministry in Kabul, an Afghan employee turned his gun on two American NATO advisors, killing them. Despite U.S. efforts at sensitivity training, said Tom Engelhardt and Nick Terse in Salon.com, our troops keep displaying contempt for the people we're supposedly helping. This year alone has brought revelations that a 12-soldier kill team was hunting civilians for sport, and a video of Marines urinating on dead Afghans. Now, with the burning of Qurans endangering every American there, we may be witnessing the final unraveling of this ill-advised war of occupation. The Quran burning was no mistake, said the Washington Times. The Qurans had been removed from a prison library where Afghan inmates were secretly communicating with each other by scrawling jihadist messages in the Islamic holy book's margins. By apologizing, Obama caved to the extremist view and gave the Taliban another victory. Obama's policy to ease out of Afghanistan is in deep disarray, said Walter Russell Mead in the AmericanInterest.com. By announcing that most U.S. forces will be withdrawn by 2014, Obama essentially told the Taliban that the U.S. is on the brink of psychological, if not military, defeat. The least bad option left is to rescind the commitment to withdraw and hunker down for an indefinite stay, making it clear to our enemies that the U.S. won't fold under pressure. Why stay when we're not wanted, said Glenn Greenwald in Salon.com. The rage displayed over the past week reflects the justified grievances of a people we've treated like pawns in a game of geopolitical chess. Imagine the American reaction if a Muslim army occupied the U.S. for 10 years, repeatedly killed women and children in airstrikes, and burned American flags or a stack of Bibles in a garbage dump. Afghans are now sending a simple message to the U.S. Get out of our country. Since this administration lacks the will to destroy the Taliban, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com, we should leave now. People who consider a book more sacred than human life really aren't worth fighting for. Despite our war weariness, said the Washington Post, we can't just abandon Afghanistan to Islamic extremists. The only secure and honorable means of exit is to finish the work of creating an Afghan army and police force capable of defending the country. But for that strategy to succeed, said Sami Yousafzai in thedailybeast.com, American troops need to trust their Afghan partners. Over the last year, at least 36 U.S. and NATO soldiers have been killed by Afghans in police or army uniforms. As the U.S. hands over control to the Afghans, our soldiers can't afford to worry about the loyalty of the men they're training how to fight. In the months ahead, repairing that tattered sense of trust may prove even tougher than the fight against the Taliban. And now it's time to turn to the feature Good Week for and Bad Week for. And this is always a popular feature. It was a good week for mocking Angie's leg after Angelina Jolie repeatedly thrust her right leg out of a slit in her gown while posing at the Academy Awards. A Twitter page, at Angie's Right Leg, quickly amassed 40,000 followers with mocking comments. And on the web, Angie's leg was being photoshopped into famous images such as the Statue of Liberty, the moon landing, and The Last Supper. It was a good week for Rocky, the largest lobster ever caught in Maine. After the 27-pound, 40-inch-long crustacean was released back into the ocean, it's illegal to keep a lobster of that size. And it was a good week for karma. After Marine Corporal Alexander Degenhart agreed to donate bone marrow to a stranger, 2 days later, while playing the slot machines in Las Vegas, he won a $2.9 million jackpot. It was a bad week for contraception after two chimpanzees at a sanctuary in New Orleans got pregnant even though all the males had been given vasectomies. The males will now be getting another round of vasectomies, and the females will be put on birth control. It was a bad week for ice fishing after 36 parked cars at an annual ice fishing competition in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, fell through thin ice on Lake Winnebago. A warm winter has kept many Midwest lakes from freezing. And it was a bad week for everyone on Earth under age 60, after astronomers detected a 460-foot wide asteroid that might hit our planet in February 2040. The good news is that scientists aren't sure of its path. By the time they are, says NASA scientist Donald Yeamans, there will be time to mount a deflection mission to alter its course. And now, from Good Week Four and Bad Week Four, we'll turn to the People section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled, Why Hoffman Loves New York. It took a long time for Dustin Hoffman to find his home, said Matthew Garahan in the Financial Times. Growing up in Los Angeles, Hoffman was constantly on the move with his family. My father was a salesman, always trying to live above the standard of living, says Hoffman, who is now 74. He was always moving upward, but falling short of the rent, so we'd move back to where we shouldn't have left. The actor felt a pull to New York City from an early age, fueled by East Side Kids, a 1940s serial about a gang of boys from the Manhattan tenements. When I used to see them on the Saturday matinee, that's all I wanted to be. At 20, he visited New York for the first time. I got off the bus, and in front of me across the street, there is a guy urinating on a bus tire. and full view of everyone. My first thought was, I'm home. I love New York from then on. That affection almost killed him. In 1970, members of the radical left-wing Weather Underground accidentally blew themselves up with dynamite in the house next to his. There was a large gaping hole where my desk had been. What would have happened if he'd been sitting there when the bomb went off? Well, he says, laughing, it would have been a shorter career. The next item is the Queen's unexpected visitor. Michael Fagan has seen Queen Elizabeth II, Queen Elizabeth II, in her 90, said Emily Duggan in the London Independent. In 1982, the 32-year-old petty criminal and drug user scaled the walls of Buckingham Palace and ended up in the British monarch's bedroom. Even now, he's not sure why he did it, but suspects he was still affected by some magic mushrooms he'd taken months earlier. Fagan prowled around the palace that night. It was like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, he says, before escaping through a garden door. A few weeks later, he decided to do it again. I was scareder than I'd ever been, he says, recalling the moment when he pulled back the curtains on Her Majesty's bed and saw the Queen staring up at him. Then she speaks, and it's like the finest glass you can imagine breaking. What are you doing here? He didn't have time to answer the question. She went past me and ran out of the room, her little bare feet running across the floor. Until the police arrived, he was guarded by an unarmed footman who gave him a glass of whiskey. He said, mate, you look like you need a drink. His name was Wybrew, which is a funny name for someone offering you a drink, isn't it? And the final column here from the People section, Clooney's painful awakening. George Clooney is acutely aware of his own mortality, said Tim Tiemann in the London Times. While shooting Syriana in 2005, the actor suffered a serious injury to the base of his neck, which left him in agony with spinal fluid leaking out of his nose. Lying in a hospital bed, he considered suicide. I was in real trouble, says Clooney, 50. For the first time, I contemplated whether I had accomplished all I wanted. I felt I was going to die or have to die. I felt I couldn't live with so much pain. He had three operations, but the pain is still with him. I know when I wake up, it will always feel like a hangover, but I can't mourn what I used to be. His health aside, Clooney is also aware that the clock is ticking on his Hollywood career. There's only a certain amount of time, about 10 years, he thinks, when you get the keys to the kingdom. I'm terrified of the moment when you're the guy who goes to the studio and says, I've got this idea, and they're like, thanks for stopping by, and you walk out and they roll their eyes. Now we'll turn to the briefing section from the Week magazine. This week it is entitled, Depending on Food Stamps. One in seven Americans receives aid to buy food. Are we feeding the hungry or breeding dependency? What are food stamps? They're a form of aid provided by the federal government to low-income households to help them buy food. The term food stamps comes from the coupon-like stamps used during the War on Poverty in the 1960s, although they were phased out in 2004 in favor of a plastic debit card, and they're refilled electronically each month. In 2008, the government rechristened the program Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, but most people still call it food stamps, and the program has become a political flashpoint since GOP presidential candidate Newt Gingrich said in January that more people have been put on food stamps by Barack Obama than any president in American history. Is that true? There can be no dispute that the number of people added to food stamp rolls since 2008 is larger than any previous president's term. Last year, 45 million Americans, 14% of the population, received food stamps. In 2008, before Obama took office, about 28 million did. But the number of recipients has risen steadily over the last decade and actually grew by a higher percentage under the 8 years of George W. Bush's administration than it has under Obama. Obama so far. Much of the expansion came at the end of the Bush administration during the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. So the recession caused the increase? A large part of it, but there were other factors as well. Millions of people lost jobs in the last 4 years, and being plunged into poverty made them eligible for food assistance. That's the way this program is designed, said Kevin Concannon, the head of the USDA's Food and Nutrition Service. Some 15% of the population, the highest rate since 1993, now lives at or below the poverty level, which is defined as $19,090 per year for a family of three. The average food stamp household of 2.2 people receives $287 in monthly food assistance benefits, or about $72 a week. That's not a lot to feed two people, but food stamp spending adds up. It has quadrupled in the course of the last 10 years to a total this year of $80.4 billion. Critics blame that cost explosion on relaxed eligibility standards that began under the Bush administration and on a boost in monthly benefits put through by Obama as part of the 2009 stimulus package. Obama increased the amount of time people could stay on food stamps and added about $80 to the monthly benefits of a family of four. No program in our government has surged out of control more dramatically than food stamps, said Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama. Do you think there are four times as many people who need food stamps today as in 2001? Who qualifies for food stamps? Three-quarters of SNAP recipients are children, teenagers, senior citizens, and people with disabilities, according to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. The average recipient household has a gross income of $8,532 a year, or just $711 per month. While Gingrich has said that African Americans should demand paychecks and not be satisfied with food stamps, they account for just 22% of recipients. About 34% of food stamp recipients are white and 16% Hispanic, with the rest being Asian, Native American, and unidentified. Four of 10 SNAP households have one family member who has a job, one with wages so low that the household still qualifies. Is there fraud in the program? Undoubtedly, as there is in all government aid programs. In Pennsylvania, 178 grocery and convenience stores were caught trading cash for food stamps last year. And in New York City, where recipients must be fingerprinted, officials discovered 1,900 people who were using two names to receive double benefits, saving taxpayers just over $5 million. Citing widespread reports of fraud and abuse, Sessions has asked the USDA to shore up its lax oversight of the food stamp program. Somehow, he said, a Michigan man was able to keep collecting food stamps after he won a $2 million lottery jackpot, while a Washington State couple stayed on the rolls while living in a $1.2 million home. The USDA, however, argues that the amount of fraud is relatively low. In fiscal 2011, states disqualified 44,483 individuals for fraud, one-tenth of 1% of program participants. Still, even the USDA admits that fraud costs the program an estimated $750 million a year. Can spending be reduced? Republicans are calling for new tests limiting benefits to the truly needy, and the idea is gaining traction. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett, for example, has proposed an asset test that would deny food stamps to households with assets of more than $5,500. Florida has passed a law requiring recipients to be drug tested, which is now being challenged in court. But such tweaks to the system won't significantly reduce the eligibility rolls, the overall cost, or the problem of dependence. Only an improved economy and more jobs will do that. And while it makes sense to limit food stamp benefits to those who truly need them, says former Bush speechwriter Michael Gerson, reformers should remember that this is one government program that has shown measurable results, the improvement of millions of lives. And our footnote column to this particular article is entitled Living on Food Stamps. What do you eat on $4.06 a day? Las Vegas Mayor Carolyn Goodwin took a local food bank's challenge to live for 5 days on the food stamp allowance for a single Nevadan. Breakfast was Cheerios, lunch canned soup, and dinner tuna sandwiches or macaroni and cheese. I didn't get to put any fruit on my meal plan, Goodman said, noting that healthy food tends to be more expensive than processed food. It's a good thing that I love tomato soup. The government does not track what people buy with food stamps, and the rules allow almost any food or food product that can be cooked or heated at home. It's just a small help, said Josephine Gonzalez, an unemployed single mother. It's not making our lives luxurious. Now let's take a look at the best columns in the U.S. for this past week from the Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, The GOP's Suicidal Swing to the Right. And this one was written by David Brooks in the New York Times. If Republicans lose to President Obama this fall, said David Brooks, party leaders should not blame the eventual nominee. They should blame themselves. In recent years, the GOP's best minds have stood mute while white ring ideologues seized control of the party. Out of fear of being contemptuously labeled rhinos, Republicans in name only, Republican candidates have moved steadily to the right, condemning illegal immigrants, promising war with Iran, and vowing never to raise taxes on anyone. And in a year when the GOP had an excellent chance to defeat President Obama, the ideologues have trashed the party's reputation by swinging from one embarrassing and unelectable option to the next. Bachman, Trump, Cain, Perry, Gingrich, Santorum. Now, with polls showing independent voters swinging to Obama by a margin of 22 points, mainstream Republicans are wringing their hands. But where were they when the party was being redefined by Sarah Palin, Glenn Beck, and the Tea Party? They were silent and hoping the insanity would soon pass. It hasn't. The next column is Why Doctors Refuse Heroic Medical Care by Ken Murray in the Wall Street Journal. Most doctors die differently than their patients, said Ken Murray. When our time comes, those of us who've spent our lives in the healthcare system tend to decline aggressive treatment to save our lives. Take my friend Charlie, for example, a 68-year-old orthopedist who discovered he had pancreatic cancer. He was offered experimental surgery that might have given him 15% odds of survival, albeit with a poor quality of life. Charlie declined that option and went home to spend his last months with his family. He died serenely and gently in his own bed several months later. Having seen so many people die, doctors know that heroic measures to prolong life often succeed only in providing a few extra weeks or months of suffering and indignity. Unfortunately, most people would rather not think about death, so only 20% have written living wills that give them control over how their lives end. That's a pity. It's time to think about this now. Like most doctors, I have made it clear that when my time comes, I will go gently into that good night. The next column is entitled, Teens Who Can't Be Embarrassed by Megan Daum in the Los Angeles Times. How do you shame a generation without shame, asked Megan Daum. That's the problem confronted by parents like Tommy Jordan of North Carolina, who recently discovered that his 15-year-old daughter, Hannah, was complaining profanely on Facebook that her parents treated her like a damn slave because they asked her to do chores. Embarrassed by Hannah's public display of disrespect, the dad took her laptop out to the yard, shot it 9 times, and posted the video to YouTube for all those kids who thought it was cool how rebellious you were. The video became a national sensation, but Hannah didn't care. She hasn't posted any response, while her father has felt a need to defend himself at great length. There's an unbridgeable gap between the generations now. Adults still cringe when a private problem is publicly aired, while for teens raised on social media, privacy is an arcane concept. With his video, Jordan tried to embarrass someone who's so accustomed to people exposing themselves online that it doesn't occur to her to be embarrassed. Shame? LOL. Now we'll flip to the back of the magazine, the Week magazine, for the last word. Our column this week is entitled Top Gun, the Glock, an ugly plastic Australian pistol, became America's gun, says Paul Barrett, by seducing the police. April 11th, 1986 was the bloodiest day in FBI history. The bank robbers were ex-soldiers turning psychopaths, a pair of expert marksmen armed with semi-automatic weapons, and they had no intention of surrendering. After a four-minute firefight on the streets of Miami, both gunmen were killed by a heroic agent. The toll for the FBI was terrible. Two agents dead, three permanently crippled, and two more severely injured. Gun battle looked like the OK Corral, the Palm Beach Post declared. Lieutenant John H. Rutherford of the Jacksonville, Florida Sheriff's Office heard about the shootout later that day. The bad guys, he recalled, were starting to carry high-capacity weapons. In the chaos of the shootout, the federal agents struggled to reload their revolvers, jamming cartridges one after another into 5- and 6-shot Smith & Wessons. One bank robber, armed with a Ruger semi-automatic rifle, merely had to snap a new magazine into his gun to have another 20 rounds instantly. His partner carried a 12-gauge shotgun with extended 8-round capacity. They were armed for a small war. The FBI had revolvers. That was a scary, terrible thing to hear about, said Rutherford. If the FBI is outgunned, something is wrong. This perception is widely shared by cops, politicians, and law-abiding firearms owners. The criminals were now better armed than the forces of order. The next year, Rutherford received the assignment to recommend a new handgun to replace the Smith & Wesson revolvers that his department issued. His counterparts in hundreds of local, state, and federal police agencies were given similar missions. My job, Rutherford told me, was to find a better gun. Rutherford had hunted as a boy and liked guns. He kept a framed copy of the Second Amendment on his office wall and taught his two children to shoot. He carried a handgun at all times, on and off duty, even to church on Sunday, which annoyed his wife. But as of 1987, he had little experience with semi-automatic pistols. He knew only revolvers. So he had the department hire an outside consultant to help sort through the many options on the market. He chose Emmanuel Capelsone, a well-known firearms trainer. Gun manufacturers from all over the world sent the sheriff's office their latest models, a dozen in all. Rutherford and a brain trust of fellow officers with firearms expertise gathered to examine the candidate guns. I pull out this black box and pop the thing open, and here's this Glock, Rutherford recalled. I'm like, what the heck is this? I'm tapping it on the table. It's plastic. What the hell? And there's no hammer on this thing. I literally said, we don't want any crap like this, and I slung it over onto the couch. Capelsone noticed the discarded Glock. You need to give it a chance, he said. His words carried weight. Capelsone, who came from New Jersey, had a national reputation and heavy connections at the National Rifle Association. His credentials were unusual in the weapons training business. He held a B.A. in English Literature from Yale and a law degree from Harvard. Capelson's suggestion that the Austrian pistol be taken seriously proved prescient. Within a few days, we were fighting over who was going to get the Glock, Rutherford said. It's just like shooting a revolver, and that's what everybody liked about it. You pull it out, you pull the trigger, and you put it away. That was the beauty of it. The Glock had another advantage, a light, steady trigger pull. The Smith & Wesson 38 caliber guns in use in Jacksonville had a heavy pull of 12 to 14 pounds, standard for revolvers. Shooters who train regularly can achieve accuracy with a heavy trigger, but only a small minority of cops practice diligently. The average officer is a mediocre shot, or worse. With a Glock, poor marksmen become adequate. Moderately skilled shooters began grouping rounds in small bunches near dead center of their target. The pistol's gentle 5-pound trigger action doesn't require the sort of muscular squeeze that can cause the user to jerk the gun off target. When word got out that Rutherford was leaning toward the Glock, some of his superiors warned him that it could be risky. "Now, John," he recalled one senior officer telling him, "you know the sheriff and the undersheriff. They really like Smith & Wesson." Smith & Wesson was what the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office has always known. It was the American cop's brand. But Rutherford was adamant. He had worked for months on his report. He said, "Now you want me to change it to something else that I know is not the best gun?" During a two-hour presentation to the sheriff, he stressed the Glock's accuracy and safety advantages as he saw them. He explained that the Austrian pistol was much easier to maintain because it had only 34 parts. The Smith & Wesson 645 had more than 100. And as beloved as the brand had been, Smith & Wesson had allowed its manufacturing quality to slip, Rutherford told his superiors. Out of a shipment of 40 new Smith & Wesson revolvers, 3 or 4 would malfunction right out of the box. A decision came quickly. "We're buying Glocks," the sheriff said. An order went to Glock for 900 pistols to arm the Jacksonville force. Over the next 6 months, more than 100 police agencies around the country requested copies of Rutherford's 90-page report on Glock. 22 years later, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, which Rutherford now presides over as sheriff, has 1,600 officers. It still arms them with Glock pistols. Emmanuel Capelson's recommendation of the Glock wasn't happenstance. In mid-1986, Carl Walter, an energetic Austrian gun salesman, began putting some of the country's most admired shooting instructors on contract to spread the word about Glocks. This melding of training and marketing became a company hallmark, and Capelson was one of the specialists Walter hired. In some cities, the Glock gun instructors were paid by the local authorities. That's the way it worked in Jacksonville. In other situations, Glock dispatched Capelson or another trainer as part of the procurement deal, a freebie for the new customer. After Jacksonville placed its order for the Glocks, the company sent Capelson back to Florida to provide transitional training on the company's dime. Carl Walter had the genius at that time to take the training programs on the road, Capelson said. You had to go to Smith & Wesson Academy if you were going to use the Smith & Wesson. If your agency was going to adopt the Glock, Walter would send some training your way. Many times instructors from neighboring agencies attended these sessions out of curiosity, or Glock would sponsor an open house seminar for all federal, state, and municipal trainers in a given region. The effect of it was to get Glocks in the hands of instructors all over the country, Capelson explained. This was just a brilliant way to sell this gun. Until the early 80s, Walter roamed the United States in a motorhome customized as a rolling arsenal. Once he was exclusively the lead salesman for the Glock, he still visited trade shows, government agencies, and small towns like Marietta, Georgia, making deals. In Marietta, he won over the police chief in 1988 by promising to arm his 100-person force for free. The Marietta PD simply exchanged 126 old handguns for 100 new Glock 17s. The deal worked financially because of the company's startlingly low manufacturing costs, which Glock was able to push down even further to less than $100 a unit. As its production volume grew, the plastic gun was finding steady acceptance among U.S. law enforcement, but the biggest prize was still out there, New York. New York City has the largest police force in the United States with 35,000 officers, more than twice the size of the FBI. Other departments take cues from the NYPD. At the same time, New York itself is not a gun-friendly jurisdiction. It has strict local gun control laws, and while the state troopers based upstate in Albany were receptive to Glock, the leadership of the NYPD imposed a brand-specific ban on the Austrian gun in early 1986, based on fears that the plastic gun could elude metal detectors. Despite that, in May 1986, a contingent of New York police trainers invited Walter to make an unofficial presentation at the department's range. To his surprise, 20 firearms instructors showed up. He had brought only a handful of sample pistols. Not to worry, his host told him. Several had privately obtained Glock 17s and retrieved them from their lockers. Walter took this as a promising sign. Some of New York's top in-house firearms trainers were curious enough about what he was selling to spend their own money on the gun, and in the process violate the ban on possessing a Glock within city limits. That summer, with the prohibition still in place, the Emergency Services Unit of the NYPD, what other cities call SWAT, quietly ordered 70 Glocks, another hopeful development. In June 1986, the limitations of the six-shot revolver were illustrated in a gunfight in Queens. Rookie officer Scott Gatle chased a gunman who opened fire on him. Gatle leaped for cover behind a stoop and shot back, emptying his .38 caliber Smith & Wesson. As he tried to reload, the gunman stepped forward and fired a fatal shot into the left side of Gatle's forehead. The gunman fired a total of 9 shots from a 9mm semi-automatic. Every cop knows about Scott, a fellow officer later said. He's an example of a cop who did everything he was supposed to do but ended up dying because of a second-rate piece of equipment. Then in September 1988, the Associated Press landed a scoop that ricocheted around the city's media and beyond. The New York Police Commissioner, Benjamin Ward, was carrying a Glock 17. Police Commissioner Benjamin Ward is licensed to carry a controversial plastic super pistol that is banned in New York City, the New York Post reported. Super gun, can you imagine? Carl Walter would muse more than 2 decades later. You can't buy that kind of attention, not for $50 million, not for $100 million. A day after the Ward disclosure, the NYPD ended its Glock ban. A deputy police commissioner explained that research had demonstrated that the gun could not be defined as an undetectable weapon and, in fact, can be detected with today's present technology in the security field. From that moment on, everything started to roll, Walter said. Soon, hundreds of NYPD narcotics detectives, organized crime investigators, and other specialized units were carrying Glocks. The brand became one of 3 that New York authorizes, and about 20,000 of the city's officers carry a Glock. After it won over New York, the ugly plastic sidearm from Austria was embraced by 2/3 of all U.S. police departments. It has been glamorized in countless Hollywood movies and featured as a ubiquitous presence on primetime TV, rhapsodized about by hip-hop artists, and coveted by cops and crooks alike. It is the gun that protects us and the gun that hunts us, the weapon used by Jared Loughner to shoot Representative Gabrielle Giffords and 18 others in Tucson. And Giffords herself told reporters in 2010, "I have a Glock 9mm and I'm a pretty good shot." For better or for worse, the Glock has truly become America's gun. And that was adapted from Glock, The Rise of America's Gun, an article copyrighted in 2012 by Paul M. Barrett and published by Crown Publishers. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for March 9th, 2012. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we'll look at the talking point section here. Our first item is entitled Mormons Explaining Posthumous Baptism. Did you know that Humphrey Bogart, Elvis Presley, Anne Frank, and Joan of Arc all are Mormons? Said Jason Horowitz in the Washington Post, they might not have been in life, but they are among the hundreds of millions of people baptized posthumously by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Mormons believe that their proxy baptisms offer deceased non-Mormons a second shot at salvation. In 1995, the Church agreed to baptize only ancestors of Mormons after being caught secretly making Mormons of thousands of Holocaust victims. But last week it was revealed that some individual Mormons were at it again, belatedly baptizing the parents of Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal and author Elie Wiesel. Jewish groups want presidential candidate Mitt Romney to speak out against this ghoulish ritual, said Martin Peretz in the NewRepublic.com. Romney, who has said that he'd performed retroactive baptisms himself, should assure Jews he'll protect their ancestors from his fellow Mormons' salvationist impulses. Who cares what Mormons are doing in the privacy of their temples, said Anshul Pfeiffer in the Tel Aviv Haaretz. All monotheistic religions believe they hold the only key to salvation, and it poses no threat to any faithful Jews that a group of goyim now thinks their ancestors are Mormons. As a Mormon, I can assure you that we perform these proxy baptisms respectfully, said Michael Otterson in the Washington Post, and the dead have the choice to accept or reject the gesture. When I performed a proxy baptism for my Christian father, I wasn't trying to erase his beliefs, but to offer him eternal life. It is because we value and respect every life and its eternal potential that we do what we do. Still, the baptism issue poses a problem for Romney, said Naomi Dechter in CommentaryMagazine.com. Sooner or later, he'll have to address why his church has baptized dead people who had no desire to be Mormons, which not only Jews will find offensive. Romney is hardly responsible for everything Mormons do, said Michael Walsh in NationalReview.com, but he wins the nomination, and if he does, Obama's minions in the media will pound Mitt into the dirt with Joseph Smith's golden plates. Romney will be asked to defend every practice of the LDS Church, all in the aim of making him seem weird. Team Romney better be ready, because his religion will definitely not be off the table. The next item from Talking Points is Climate Change, When Scientists Play Dirty. For believers in a science that supposedly is settled, global warming advocates sure spend a lot of time trying to squash dissent, said the Washington Times in an editorial. Last week, climate scientist Peter Gleick confessed to using a false identity to steal documents from the Heartland Institute, a conservative think tank skeptical of man-made climate change. Gleick then distributed the Heartland documents to environmental blogs, hoping to discredit the group's work as bought and paid for by big business. But that particular line of attack is especially pathetic, as Heartland's annual budget is just $6 million compared to $26.1 billion in climate change programs and President Obama's stimulus bill alone. By using Watergate-style tactics, climate alarmists have revealed the weakness of their own argument. Gleick apparently added a faked confidential strategy memo to the stolen documents to make Heartland look bad, said Robert Trzesinski in RealClearPolitics.com. That compels honest observers to ask, if the warmists were willing to deceive us on this, what else have they been deceiving us about? If anyone is guilty of deception, it's Heartland, said Leslie Kaufman in the New York Times. The documents show that Heartland was using a $100,000 pledge from an anonymous donor to develop a school curriculum that would teach kids over that there is a major scientific controversy over whether greenhouse gas emissions are warming the planet. That's simply not true. The overwhelming majority of climate scientists believe the link is clear. Gleick might have lied to get this information, said James Garvey in the London Guardian, but it was the right thing to do, Heartland deliberately set out to muddy public opinion and stop governments from taking vital action on climate change. Thanks to GLIKE, the inner workings of the climate skeptic lobby have now been exposed for all to see. Perhaps more scientists should play dirty. What a terrible idea, said John McQuaid in Forbes.com. The conspiracy theorists who claim that climate change is a hoax have no facts to rely on. Instead, they insist there's a conspiracy to fool the public, perpetrated by scientists, scientific bodies, and the government. But the low standards of the skeptics mean that scientists and anyone who wants to honestly explore what's happening to the climate must maintain the highest standards. Otherwise, the lines between fact and political argument start to blur, an ideal environment for hoax stories to flourish. As we move towards the end of our program for this week, let's take a look at a few shorter items from the Talking Point section of the Week magazine. The first one, some 600,000 job openings went unfulfilled in 2011 because employers could not find workers with the right skills, according to a survey of U.S. manufacturers. Manufacturers say they now need workers who are trained in the use of computers, automation, and other technologies. Residents of at least six states have filed lawsuits challenging Barack Obama's eligibility to be a presidential candidate in 2012, insisting that he is not a natural-born citizen of the United States. The percentage of Americans with tattoos rose from 14% in 2008 to 21% last year, and women are now more likely to be inked than men. Of those with tattoos, 30% say their ink makes them feel sexier, and 25% say it makes them feel rebellious. Four out of five of the millions of tropical fish that are caught in the wild to be sold as pets die before or soon after they reach home aquariums. And the suicide rate in New York City is about half the national average. City officials say the low rate is primarily the result of the city's strict gun laws. Only 12% of suicides in New York involve firearms, while the national figure is 51%, and in the most suicide-prone states, it is 66%. And now we'll turn to the poll watch for this week from the Week magazine, dated March 9, 2012. Americans are getting more cautious about social media. 63% say they've deleted people from their friends list. 44% have deleted comments from their profile, and 37% have untagged photos of themselves. 58% say they set their main online profile to private so that only friends can see it. And 51% of Americans now disapprove of the federal government's bailout of U.S. automakers, while 44% approve. Among Republicans, that number is 73% that say they disapprove about the bailout of U.S. automakers that took place a couple of years ago. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of the Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.